Les colloques du Collège de France.
So I'll be talking about inaccuracies in fiction. So sometimes when we are reading a book or we are watching a film, we tend to reject some inaccuracies that we think make the work less valuable. This is a case of an anachronism or an inaccuracy that we would reject. Some novels and films contain a lot of factual and historical inaccuracies, and although they are considered to be works of fiction, we still intuitively reject some of these inaccuracies. But as works of fiction, we obviously don't reject all of the inaccuracies that we see, and we even praise some of them. This is the case with Jesus Christ Superstar or Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. So this is a problem that the philosopher Christopher Bartle has talked about, and he calls this problem the puzzle of historical inaccuracy. But he focuses mainly on historical inaccuracies, and I think, as John Holiday, that the problem is about inaccuracies in general, including factual inaccuracies. So I adopt his extended version, which renames the puzzle as the puzzle of factual inaccuracy criticism, although I'll be focusing mainly on historical inaccuracies because these are the examples they are discussed. So according to the puzzle, we tend to have two intuitive ideas at the same time. We think that inaccuracies damage the aesthetic value of works of fiction, but we also think that works of fiction should be free from the constraints of truth because they are works of fiction. So the aim of my talk is to analyze Fileva's solution to Bartle's puzzle. So my plan will be to see if Fileva's proposal solves Bartle's puzzle, and if it meets his two desiderata for being a successful solution to the puzzle. So according to Bartle, any solution to the puzzle has to meet two desiderata. The first one is to distinguish between cases of inaccuracies that are considered flaws and cases that are not considered flaws. And the second desideratum is to give a unified account of works that are criticized for their inaccuracies. I will try to show some of the challenges Fileva's theory faces, and I will try to develop a more complete solution to the puzzle. Okay, so some examples. Both Fileva and Bartle take U571 as a starting point. This is a film from the 2000s by Jonathan Mostow. It's set in the Second World War, and it's about a group of soldiers during the Battle of the Atlantic infiltrating in a German boat to steal the Enigma machine. The main historical inaccuracy is that, whereas in real life it was the British soldiers who captured the Enigma machine, in the film claims or makes believe that it was the Americans who captured the Enigma machine. And this was done because, as Jonathan Mostow said, they wanted to sell the film in Hollywood to an American audience, so they just changed the facts. Something similar has happened with Braveheart, but in this case, it's not. I think most of the inaccuracies in Braveheart are not intentional. They are just anachronisms or mistakes. This is what some critics have said about Braveheart. For instance, what Braveheart delivered is a hodgepodge of history and make-believe, resulting in one of the most historical and accurate historical epics of all time. It almost makes Troy look like a documentary. And it has also happened with Ridley Scott's Napoleon. I think it's also happening right now with Gladiator 2. From literature, we have this example by Mark Rowe. in which George Eliot, in a passage of Middlemark, describes the effects of opium as dilating the pupils instead of contracting them. Obviously, this mistake is not as big as the mistakes that these films show, but George Eliot felt uncomfortable enough to change this on a later edition of the novel. So, more examples. As you can see, Jesus Christ Superstar historical inaccuracies doesn't seem to be a problem because those are Roman soldiers, and obviously they are not dressing as real Roman soldiers, but no one seems to care about this because it's a musical. Something similar happens in The Lord of the Rings. There are a lot of made-up stuff like magic, hobbits, and so on, and no one cares that these things, that the book talks about these things. And then we have another example, which is Shakespeare Julius Caesar, which is also inaccurate in some respects. For instance, it shows a mechanical clock, where mechanical clocks were not invented until centuries later. It also changes Brutus' motives for joining the conspiracy against Julius Caesar, but this doesn't seem to be a flaw. So Phileas gives a solution to Bartel's puzzle, but by saying that there is a conversational contract between authors and audiences that is determined by genre. This conversational contract implies that there are warranted expectations of accuracy, to some extent. And her contract allows her to distinguish between inaccuracies that are flaws and inaccuracies that are not. So, for instance, translating a work from one language to another will not constitute an artistic or an aesthetic flaw because it's permitted by the contract. As I was saying, what the contract implies will depend on the genre of the work. That's why we don't care about the inaccuracies in a fantasy novel like The Lord of the Rings or a musical like Jesus Christ Superstar. And some inaccuracies are permitted according to this contract because they are justified on artistic grounds, so they are imaginatively used to serve a higher aesthetic goal, as she says. And some inaccuracies are not permitted because they are due to a plurality of non-artistic reasons, for instance, sloppy research, to meet propagandistic goals, etc. So the inaccuracies in the U-boat film are ruled out by the contract because they aim to achieve a self-serving or propagandistic goal, which is selling the film to an American audience. The inaccuracies in Napoleon or Braveheart are ruled out by the contract because they are mistakes. They are due to ignorance or sloppy research. And the inaccuracies in Shakespeare's Julius Caesar are permitted and praised because apparently they are used to serve an aesthetic goal. So it seems that he might have put a mechanical clock there to underline the passing of time, or that he changed Brutus' motives to add a sense of tragedy to the story. And subverting a genre can also enhance the work's aesthetic value. So there are works like the Japanese film Vengeance is Mine or The Shining that violate the audience's expectations, but they do that in an artistic way, so that we do not seem to matter. And as I was saying, Jesus Christ Superstar is just a musical, so if someone criticizes it for being inaccurate, they would just not get the point. I think Phileo proposes a good solution to Bartel's puzzle, but I think that there are certain things that can be improved. First of all, it's not clear what counts as an artistic justification or as a higher aesthetic goal. It seems that this is a bit subjective. She herself gives an example of a discussion she had with her father regarding, I think it was Quo Vadis, and apparently this work is also historically inaccurate, but Phileba's father was saying that the artistic aims of the work and the main theme justifies the inaccuracies, and she didn't agree. So it's not clear that what an artistic justification should be. And sometimes there are other kinds of justifications that I don't think are necessarily artistic, but that we accept. For instance, if we watch a film from the 50s and it has bad special effects, I don't think that's an artistic justification, but we would still accept that it's more inaccurate than a film made today. I also think that Fileva's solution meets Bartel's first desideratum, but not the second. She successfully distinguishes between inaccuracies that are flaws and inaccuracies that aren't, but she gives a plurality of reasons why we reject inaccuracies. For instance, we reject them because they are used to meet a self-serving aim, because they are mistakes, they are due to the author's ignorance in a topic. Since she gives a plurality of reasons, unity can only be given in a very general sense. Also, she doesn't really explain why there is a conversational contract surrounding fiction. Seems that she follows Grice's idea, but the problem is that although I think fictions share a lot of things and a lot of features with conversations, Grice talks about conversation as having the aim of communicating effectively, whereas I think this is maybe one of many aims fiction has, but not, doesn't necessarily have to have that aim. Also, I don't know, it seems odd to talk about fiction as a conversation because it's a unidirectional conversation, seems to be more private than fictions. Also, it is unclear whether the contract aims to describe how audiences and authors behave or to prescribe how they should behave, because if she wants this contract to be descriptive, then I think there's a problem because not everyone recognizes inaccuracies in fiction. You only recognize an inaccuracy when you have background knowledge about about history or about certain facts. If you watch the U-Boat film and you know nothing about the Enigma machine, then you can still watch it and the inaccuracy would not count as a flaw for you because you wouldn't even recognize it. So she only describes what some audiences do, but not everyone. And if she wants to prescribe why audiences should reject these inaccuracies, she should at least provide an aim for why we should adopt this contract and follow its guidelines. So yeah, it is unclear what the main goal of following the guidelines stipulated by the contract is. So I think instead of a conversational contract, although I think the idea of a contract has some, it's interesting in some respects, I think we should be talking about a looser social practice with a normative status. I think that this social practice would allow many appropriate ways of engaging with fiction, and in some ways of engaging with fiction, it would prescribe audiences to follow certain guidelines if they want to appreciate fiction with understanding, and it would prescribe authors to follow certain guidelines if they want to achieve certain artistically valuable objectives. And I think being inaccurate to some extent can be an artistically valuable objective in fiction. I mean, inaccurate to some extent can be accepted when it is either unavoidable, as in the case of an old film, or when the author is trying to achieve something else. So I think this practice is plural and diverse. I think it changes through time and from culture to culture. I think it's conventional, it's based on conventions, and it's contingent. What the practice implies now, it's not necessary something that it will imply in the future. It's basically a bit arbitrary in that sense. It is a practice that generates valuable objectives. So, for instance, within the practice of fiction, creating an engaging story is a valuable objective. And it also provides guidelines or heuristics to meet them. So it has a normative status. In this practice, things are agreed tacitly. Participants in the practice adopt both a cooperative assumption, which is similar to Grice's cooperative principle, but more vague. It just implies that when engaged with the practice of fiction, both authors and audiences are going to share some common interests. And it also takes a reality assumption as a default. So this means that we take the world as a background when we are engaging with fiction, because authors do not have time or space to specify everything that is true in the work, so we just assume that certain facts about the world are true in the work, unless the work itself says otherwise, or the genre. And there's also this idea of engaging with fiction as fiction. So, for instance, adopting the cooperative assumption entails engaging with fiction as fiction, which means, for instance, if you have a book, not using the book as a paperweight, but as a work of fiction, and following the standard ways in which we would read a book. There are also various practices in the practice of fiction, and depending on what we're interested in doing, if we're interested in understanding the work, interpreting the work, creating the work, representing the work, the guidelines, objectives, etc., are going to be different. And as Philip, I also think that the practice varies from genre to genre. This is what Kendall Walton says about something similar when talking about aesthetic value and the practice of art. I'm just going to skip it. These are more particular aspects of the practice that concern Bartel's puzzle. I think Bartel's puzzle does not always arise. As I was saying, there are many ways of engaging with fiction. Sometimes we engage with fiction to be entertained or to be absorbed by it. And in those cases, we are not prescribed or invited to import a lot of background knowledge, only the background knowledge that is enough to kind of follow the story, to be entertained by it. But there are other ways of engaging with fiction. Sometimes we engage with fiction to appreciate fiction. In this sense, I take fiction as Noel Carroll, appreciating as Noel Carroll does, as sizing up the value of a work, not only as a matter of taste or as regarding it positively. So appreciating fiction means kind of evaluating fiction, seeing if it is valuable as literary fiction or as a film. And also there's this. Sometimes we engage with fiction in a way that we want to appreciate it with understanding. We don't only want to be entertained by it. And in those cases, the practice of fiction prescribes us to import more background knowledge and to do a series of things. So appreciating a work with understanding entails, first of all, engaging with the work directly. If you read a summary of a work, or if you watch a summary of a film, then you will won't be able to appreciate it. It also entails taking into account the work's origins and aims, analyzing it as belonging to the relevant genre or category, taking into account some relevant authorial intentions and the historical context. And as I was saying, importing maybe more background knowledge that we would usually import if we were just seeking entertainment. And also, we also want to analyze the author's achievement, what the author is achieving by creating this work. So there is some... theories. There are some theories in aesthetics that say that artworks can be regarded as achievements of a certain kind, and that their value comes at least in part for their status as achievements. When Bradford defines achievements as competently caused processes that also involve some level of difficulty, and Dennis Dutton applies the a notion of achievement to art. He says that all kinds of artworks, not only acting or dancing, are performative because they involve the performance of a task. And so appreciating art involves grasping the author's or the artist's achievement and whether they succeeded at the task at hand. So writing a novel can be seen as an achievement. It is a difficult and competently caused process that results in a product. It's also a performance of a task. But there are different kinds of achievements. One work can be regarded as different kinds of achievements, and not every kind of achievement is artistically relevant. There are some personal achievements a work can be that we do not care about if we are appreciating a work. So we care about those achievements that are artistically relevant. Since I'm talking about film and literature, we care about cinematic and literary achievements. Okay, why accuracy matters? Why is getting the facts an artistic aim? As Walton says, we may take pleasure in admiring someone for the accomplishment of an arbitrary chosen objective. So just because an author aims to be very accurate in some when talking about some topic, that can be seen as an achievement. It seems that something we regard as positive when engaging with literary fiction or film is that the films are current, that they are very similitude, and they show some level of consistency. And I think that also requires some level of accuracy. I also think that we don't only import background knowledge to the work, we also export background knowledge. So achieving consistency between what is imported and what is exported is also a relevant artistic aim, and something that also involves accuracy. And then it seems that making the imaginings more vivid also requires some level of sticking to the facts. So for instance, if you have knowledge about the Yorkshire Moor when reading Wuthering Heights, that will probably enhance how vivid your imagining of the moors in Wuthering Heights is. Okay, so now let's go back to Bartle's puzzle. So when we are appreciating the U-boat film with understanding, we are required to do a number of things. The practice prescribes us to contextualize the film, categorize the film. It also prescribes us to see what the author's achievement is, what the origins and names of the film are, and all of these kinds of things. Also requires us to import a certain level of information about the Second World War. And if we want to see to what extent the work is a good, let's say we classify it as a historical war film because it's based on a real event and obviously it's a war film, then we should regard to what extent it's a good instance of a historical war film. So is the U-boat film a good cinematic achievement? I don't think it is, because at least if we see it as an instance of a historical war film, it doesn't meet a lot of the objectives that we consider valuable in historical war films. It's not very coherent. It's not very realistic. It's not very consistent. So I don't think it's good, a good cinematic achievement, at least as an instance of that kind of achievement. But maybe we are misrepresenting the kind of achievement it is. The filmmakers said that they weren't trying to make a historical thesis, they were just trying to make a parallel history. So maybe we should judge the work as a different kind of cinematic achievement, as an instance of a parallel history. But I still don't think it's a good work as an instance of parallel history, because maybe in parallel histories, accuracy is not the most valuable aim, but a parallel history requires to be original and imaginative. And since the work still focuses on a real event, it's not original or imaginative enough. So it's still not as good as an instance of that kind of achievement. This can also be said about Napoleon or Braveheart. Jesus Christ Superstar or Julius Caesar are different kinds of artistic achievements that do not necessarily involve accuracy. Jesus Christ is a musical, and so it is achieving different things that do not necessarily involve accuracy, like having good musical pieces, things like that. And the same with Julius Caesar. I don't think the aim of the work is being very accurate. So for an accuracy to be justified, the work has to have value in beauty of other features. So even if we do not accept the inaccuracies in a work such as Julius Caesar, we still appreciate it positively because it has value in beauty of other features. It can also have value in virtue of being inaccurate. This is more similar to what Fileva says. A work can just be very inaccurate or very absurd, and it can have value as an instance of an absurd work. And it has to be justified by the conventions of the practice and genre. So this means that if it's regarded as a musical, we would not pay attention to things that we would pay attention to in other kinds of more realistic genres. And if it's unavoidable, as I was saying, it can also be justified, even if it's not justified on artistic grounds. I'm just going to present some challenges. I'm not going to discuss them. If you want to talk about any of these challenges, I'm happy to discuss them later. So the problem with my theory is that it is not clear why getting the facts right is an artistic achievement, whereas promoting American nationalism is not. If the author decides not to be cooperative, it also seems that this maybe bothers us because it poses an ethical problem, that of breaking a promise instead of an artistic one. It seems that maybe authors have complete authority over what is true in fiction, and we are just importing knowledge into the fiction that contradicts what the author says, so we just shouldn't import that kind of background knowledge. And another claim is that maybe we reject inaccuracies in works that we dislike and we justify them in the ones we prefer, and this is only a matter of psychological disposition. So I think my solution solves Bartel's puzzle and meets his desiderata, because it distinguishes between inaccuracies that bother us and inaccuracies that do not bother us. So inaccuracies bother us when they make the work not as good as the kind or kinds of artistic achievement we are appreciating it as. Inaccuracies do not bother us when they are almost impossible to avoid. They are permitted by the conventions of the practice. The author is achieving something else artistically relevant. And it gives a unified account of works that are criticized for their inaccuracies, because all works that are criticized for their inaccuracies are works in which the author chooses not to be cooperative, not to follow the guidelines of creating a good work of fiction. And then the author's achievement is simply not as good. Okay, thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.